milestone business result for a product organization and something truly worth celebrating. Chapter 40. Profile, Martina Luchenko of Microsoft. In 1993, Word 6.0 was the biggest release, feature-wise, Microsoft had ever produced. In addition to all the new features, the team had another very large objective. Their code base had diverged, and it was extremely slow and costly for Microsoft to implement Word separately for each platform, Windows, DOS, and Mac. This code convergence effort was supposed to save Microsoft substantial development time and, they tried to convince themselves, improve the offering since Word would have the same features on every platform. It also meant that there was great pressure to get the release out so they could start to gain the efficiencies of a single code base. At the time, Word for Mac was a relatively small market. It was only $60 million versus Windows, which at that point was more than a $1 billion market. If you remember, back then, Windows machines absolutely dominated, and the future of Apple was not a sure thing. However, the Mac community was also very vocal, with passionate fans of their platform, and this community had very little love for Microsoft. Power Macs were just hitting the market, which had significantly faster chips and more memory. Most of the team members were using those new computers because the Word 6.0 beta in its early days was just too slow on regular Macs. Of course, most of the Mac user base was not on new Power Macs. They were on regular Macs. Hardware upgrade cycles were much slower then. So, when Microsoft released the most full-featured word processor ever for the Mac, it crawled on their Macs. We're talking 2 minutes just to start it up. The community immediately started posting in news groups that Microsoft was trying to kill the Mac. Hate mail started streaming in from everywhere, including emails directly to Bill Gates, who would forward them to the team with messages like, "This is depressing Microsoft's stock price. Fix it." Enter Martina Luchenko, a young product manager recently out of Stanford, whose job it was to help turn this around. The team quickly learned that, while it may be a worthwhile objective to get a common code base, it's an empty victory if the product that results is not good. Moreover, users choose their devices and platforms because they value what's different, not what's the same. From the customer's point of view, they would rather wait a little longer and have a better platform-specific solution than simultaneously ship a generic product on all platforms. The team ended up focusing hard on performance and taking advantage of what the Mac could do. They looked at when and how to load fonts, since Mac users tended to have so many more than Windows users, and ensuring all Mac keyboard shortcuts still worked. They focused on word count, which is used 10 times a day by every press person, to make sure that it was lightning fast, as the press used the feature as their performance barometer. They even made it faster than the feature on Windows. The result was that in a couple of months, they produced a 6.1 release that was sent to every registered user with an apology letter, signed by Martina, along with a discount coupon for future purchases. The release succeeded in fixing the perception problems, but more important, it genuinely made the version dramatically better for the Macintosh. It was a product the Mac team could be proud of and that the team felt they should have delivered to market in the first place. This is a good example of how hard it can be to do the right thing for the customer, often in the face of massive pressures. But that's exactly what strong product managers figure out how to do. In subsequent years, not only did Microsoft once again decide to diverge the code base, they completely separated the teams into different buildings and business units and had them fully embrace all things Mac. Strategically, it was a complete 180. It's hard to estimate how important this was to both Microsoft and Apple. Even today, more than 20 years later, many businesses and consumers consider Word and the rest of Office absolutely essential to using their Mac for business and personal use. What started then became a multi-billion-dollar win for both Apple and Microsoft. There are more than 1 billion Macs and PCs running Office around the world. Martina has gone on to have a remarkable career in both product management and product marketing. From Microsoft, she went on to Netscape, where she was responsible for marketing of the Netscape browser, and then LoudCloud. And now I'm happy to say she's been my partner at SVPG for more than a decade, and she also teaches marketing at University of California at Berkeley. Let me also add that there are few things as powerful as a marketing person who's also strong at product. The combination is amazing. Discovery ideation techniques. Overview. There are, of course, any number of techniques for generating product ideas. I really haven't met many ideation techniques I haven't liked, but to me, the more relevant question is, how do we generate the types of ideas that are likely to truly help us solve the hard business problems that our leaders have asked us to focus on right now? Remarkably, in the vast majority of companies, not the ones that are good at product, the actual product teams don't do much ideation themselves. This is because what's really going on is that the ideas are already handed to the product teams in the form of prioritized features on product roadmaps, where most of the items on those roadmaps are coming either from requests from big customers or prospective customers, or from company stakeholders or execs. Unfortunately, these are rarely the quality of ideas we're looking for. In general, if the product team is given actual business problems to solve rather than solutions, and the product team does their job and interacts directly and frequently with actual users and customers, then getting a sufficient quantity and quality of product ideas is not really a problem. I have some favorite techniques that consistently deliver to the team very promising and very relevant product ideas. One important caveat, though. If you use these techniques, I am fairly certain you will get very excited by many of the ideas you discover. But that doesn't mean you should just go ahead and build them. In most cases, we will still need to test them to ensure they are valuable and usable for our customers, are feasible for our engineers, and are viable for our business. Chapter 41. Customer Interviews. The customer interview is the most basic technique I'll discuss in this book. I wish I didn't need to include it because I'd like to be able to take it for granted that product managers already know how to do this well and do it frequently. However, the reality is that this is often not the case. Or if customer interviews are happening, the product manager is not present, so the learnings are not understood viscerally or taken as seriously as they need to be. See Discovery Principle number 10 on Shared Learning. But no question, this is one of the most powerful and important skills for any product manager, and very often the source or inspiration for many breakthrough product ideas. Later, when we discuss techniques for testing your product ideas qualitatively, these skills will be a prerequisite. There are many forms of customer interviews, so this is not really a single technique. Some are informal and some are more formal. Some have a user research methodology behind them. One of my favorites is the contextual inquiry. And others are more about just getting out of the building and learning what you don't know. But in every user or customer interaction, we always have the opportunity to learn some valuable insights. Here's what I'm always trying to understand. Are your customers who you think they are? Do they really have the problems you think they have? How does the customer solve this problem today? What would be required for them to switch? Now, there are lots of ways to get these answers, and if you have access to a user researcher, you would normally follow their lead. Here are some tips for getting the most out of these learning opportunities. Frequency. Establish a regular cadence of customer interviews. This should not be a once-in-a-while thing. A bare minimum would be 2 to 3 hours of customer interviews per week, every week. Purpose. You are not trying to prove anything during these interviews, one way or the other. You are just trying to understand and learn quickly. This mindset is critical and needs to be sincere. Recruiting users and customers. I talk much more about this when we discuss the usability testing technique, but for now, be sure to talk primarily to people in your intended target market. You're looking for about an hour of their time. Location. It's always amazing to see customers in their native habitat. There's so much to learn just by observing their environment. But it's also fine to meet them somewhere convenient or have them come to your office. If you need to do this over a video call, that's not as good, but much better than not doing it all. Preparation. Be clear beforehand what problem it is you think they have, and think about how you'll either confirm or contradict that. Who should attend? My favorite is to bring three people to these interviews: the product manager, the product designer, and one of the engineers from the team. We normally rotate among those that want to attend. Usually the designer drives, because they've usually been trained how to do this well. The product manager takes notes, and the developer observes. Interview. Work to keep things natural and informal. Ask open-ended questions and try to learn what they're doing today, not so much what they wish they were doing, although that's also interesting. Afterward, debrief with your colleagues to see if you've all heard the same things and had the same learnings. If you made any promises to the customer during that session, be sure you keep them. I would argue that this hour consistently yields a great return on your time. It's critical to learn the answers to these key questions. However, I'm a big fan of taking the opportunity of a customer interview to also try out some of our product ideas. We do that after we've learned the answers to these key questions, but it's such a great opportunity, I really like to take advantage of it. Later, when we talk about testing usability and value, you will see the techniques for this. But for now, just know that you don't have to wrap up after the interview. You can follow up with a user test of your latest product ideas. Chapter 42, Concierge Test Technique. A concierge test is one of my favorite techniques for quickly generating high-quality product ideas and, at the same time, working on developing the customer understanding and empathy that's so important for motivating the team and delivering strong solutions. The concierge test is a relatively new name to describe an old but effective technique. The idea is that we do the customer's job for them, manually and personally. Just as if you went to a hotel concierge and asked if he could find you some theater tickets to a popular show. You don't really know the details of what that concierge is doing for you to get those tickets, but you do know that he's doing something. With this technique, you become the concierge. You do what the user or customer needs done for them. You may have to ask them to train you first, but you are in their shoes doing the tasks they would do. This is similar, but not the same, as spending some time with your customer service or customer success staff. That is also valuable and often a good source of product ideas as well, but that is helping customers once they call with a problem. A concierge test requires going out to the actual users and customers and asking them to show you how they work so that you can learn how to do their job and so that you can work on providing them a much better solution. If you are building a customer-enabling product, the users may be employees of your company, but the technique is the same. You go to these colleagues and ask them to teach you how they do their job. Like the principle of shared learning, it is most valuable if the product manager, the product designer, and one of the engineers does the concierge test. Chapter 43, The Power of Customer Misbehavior. Historically, the two main approaches used by good teams to come up with product opportunities have been: 1. Try to assess the market opportunities and pick potentially lucrative areas where significant pain exists. 2. Look at what the technology or data enables, what's just now possible, and match that up with the significant pain. You can think of the first as following the market and the second as following the technology. Either way can get you to a winning product. However, some of the most successful companies today have taken a third approach, and while it's not appropriate for every company, I would like to suggest that this is an extremely powerful technique that's largely underutilized and underappreciated in our industry. The third alternative is to allow and even encourage our customers to use our products to solve problems other than what we plan for and officially support. Mike Fisher, a longtime friend of mine, wrote a book called The Power of Customer Misbehavior. This book tells the eBay and Facebook stories from a viral growth perspective. But there are several other very good examples in there too. From its earliest days, eBay has always had an everything else category. This is where people could buy and sell things that we at eBay couldn't anticipate people might want to trade. And while we anticipated a lot, there were and still are thousands of categories, some of the biggest innovations and biggest surprises came from monitoring what customers wanted to do. We realized early on in the eBay situation that this was where much of the best innovation was happening, and we did everything we could think of to encourage and nurture customers using the eBay marketplace to be able to buy and sell nearly anything.
While the marketplace may have been originally designed to facilitate trading items like electronics and collectibles, soon people started trading concert tickets, fine art, and even cars.
Today, amazingly, eBay is one of the largest used car companies in the world. As you might imagine, there are some very significant differences between safely buying and transporting a car and buying a ticket that's good for one night and then worthless. But that work was only done after the demand had been established by enabling customers to transact in items and ways the team and the company didn't anticipate. Some product people can get upset when they find customers using their products for unintended use cases. This concern is usually tied to the support obligations. I'm suggesting, however, that this special case can be very strategic and well worth the investment to support. If you find your customers using your product in ways you didn't predict, this is potentially very valuable information. Dig in a little and learn what problem they are trying to solve and why they believe your product might provide the right foundation. Do this enough and you'll soon see patterns and potentially some very big product opportunities. The power of developer misbehavior. While the eBay example was intended to be used by end users, buyers and sellers, this same concept is what's behind the trend towards exposing some or all of a product's services via programmatic interfaces, public APIs. With a public API, you are essentially saying to the developer community, these are the things we can do. Perhaps you can leverage these services to do something amazing that we couldn't anticipate ourselves. Facebook's platform strategy is a good example of this. They opened up access to their social graph to discover the types of things that developers might be able to do once they could leverage this asset. I have been a longtime fan of public APIs as a part of a company's product strategy. I consider developers to be one of the consistently best sources of truly innovative product ideas. Developers are in the best position to see what's just now possible. And so many innovations are powered by these insights. Chapter 44, Hack Days. There are many variations of hack days, but in this chapter, I describe one of my favorite techniques to quickly get a range of high potential ideas that are focused on solving a pressing business or customer problem. The two main types of hack days are directed and undirected. In an undirected hack day, people can explore whatever product ideas they like, so long as it's at least loosely related to the mission of the company. In a directed hack day, there's a customer problem, for example, something is really difficult to learn and use, or it takes too long to do, or business objective we've been assigned, for example, reduce the customer churn rate or increase customer lifetime value.
And we ask people from the product teams to self-organize and work on any ideas they like that might address this objective.
The goal is for the self-organizing groups to explore their ideas and create some form of prototype that can be evaluated and, if appropriate, tested on actual users. There are two major benefits to these directed hack days. The first is practical, as the technique facilitates the inclusion of engineers at ideation. I've mentioned several times in this book that many of the best ideas come from the engineers on the team, and we need to ensure this is happening. It should be happening on an ongoing basis, but this technique will ensure it happens. The second benefit is cultural. This is one of my favorite techniques for building a team of missionaries rather than mercenaries. The engineers, if they haven't already, are now diving much deeper into the business context and playing a much larger role in terms of innovation. Discovery prototyping techniques. Overview. Prototypes of various forms have been around for as long as we've been applying technology to solve problems. Per the famous Fred Brooks quote, "Plan to throw one away, you will anyhow." While Fred's quote is as relevant today as it was when it was first published in 1975, many things have changed, not the least of which is that the tools and techniques we have for developing prototypes and testing them have progressed dramatically. That said, I continue to find teams and even people I would consider thought leaders that have a very narrow interpretation of what is meant by the term prototype. When I press people, what I typically find is that they associate the term prototype with the type that they were first exposed to. If the first one you saw was used to test for feasibility, that's what you think of. If the first one you saw was used for usability testing, that's what you think of. But there are, in fact, many very different forms of prototypes, each with different characteristics and each suited to testing different things. And yes, some people get themselves into trouble trying to use the wrong type of prototype for the job at hand. In this overview, I highlight the major classes of prototypes, and in the chapters that follow, I go into depth on each of them. Feasibility prototypes. These are written by engineers to address technical feasibility risks during product discovery, before we decide whether something is feasible. Sometimes the engineers are trying out a new technology. Sometimes it's a new algorithm. Often it is about assessing performance. The idea is for the developer to write just enough code to be able to address the feasibility risk. User prototypes. User prototypes are simulations. There is a wide spectrum of user prototypes, from those intentionally designed to look like wireframes sketched out on paper, referred to as low-fidelity user prototypes, all the way up to those that look and feel like the real thing, referred to as high-fidelity user prototypes, where it can be difficult to tell it's just a simulation. Live data prototypes. Live data prototypes are a little more complicated to explain, but they are a critically important tool for several situations. The main purpose of a live data prototype is to collect actual data so we can prove something, or at least gather some evidence, normally to find out whether an idea, a feature, a design approach, a workflow, really works. This typically means two things. First, we need the prototype to access our live data sources, and second, we need to be able to send live traffic in enough quantity to get some useful data to the prototype. The key is that we don't want to have to build, test, and deploy a commercially viable product to do this. That would take far too long, cost far too much, and very likely yield huge waste. A live data prototype costs a small fraction of what it would cost to build a commercially viable product, which is what makes this such a powerful tool. Hybrid prototypes. There are also many hybrids which combine aspects of the other types. For example, when working on search and recommendations in which we're focusing on relevance, we may need to have the prototype access live data sources, but we don't need to be able to send live traffic. In this case, we're not trying to prove anything, but we can learn a great deal by observing and discussing the results with the users. Remember that product discovery is all about coming up with the fastest, cheapest way to test out our ideas. So, depending on your particular idea and situation, you'll want to pick the flavor of prototype that best meets your needs. While we all might have our favorites, if you are competing against good product teams, you're going to need to be skilled at each of these. Chapter 45. Principles of prototypes. As discussed in Chapter 44, there are many forms of prototypes. The best choice for you depends on the particular risk being tackled and the type of product. But all forms of prototypes have certain characteristics and benefits in common. Here are five key principles behind their use. 1. The overarching purpose of any form of prototype is to learn something at a much lower cost in terms of time and effort than building out a product. All forms of prototype should require at least an order of magnitude less time and effort as the eventual product. 2. Realize that one of the key benefits of any form of prototype is to force you to think through a problem at a substantially deeper level than if we just talk about it or write something down. This is why the very act of creating a prototype so often exposes major issues otherwise left uncovered until much later. 3. Similarly, a prototype is also a powerful tool for team collaboration.
Members of the product team and business partners can all experience the prototype to develop shared understanding.
4. There are many different possible levels of fidelity for a prototype. The fidelity primarily refers to how realistic the prototype looks. There is no such thing as one appropriate level of fidelity. Sometimes we don't need the prototype to look realistic at all, and other times it needs to be very realistic. The principle is that we create the right level of fidelity for its intended purpose, and we acknowledge that lower fidelity is faster and cheaper than higher fidelity, so we only do higher fidelity when we need to. 5. The primary purpose of a prototype is to tackle one or more product risks, value, usability, feasibility, or viability, in discovery. However, in many cases, the prototype goes on to provide a second benefit, which is to communicate to the engineers and the broader organization what needs to be built. This is often referred to as prototype as spec. In many cases, the prototype is sufficient for this, but in other cases, especially when the engineers are not co-located or when the product is especially complex, the prototype will likely need to be supplemented with additional details, usually use cases, business rules, and acceptance criteria. Chapter 46, Feasibility Prototype Technique. Most of the time, your engineers will review your product ideas and tell you that they have no real concerns about feasibility. This is because they have likely built similar things many times before. However, there are several situations wherein your engineers may identify a significant feasibility risk involved in solving a particular problem they are working on. Common examples include algorithm concerns, performance concerns, scalability concerns, fault tolerance concerns, use of a technology the team has not used before, use of a third-party component or service the team has not used before, use of a legacy system the team has not used before, dependency on new or related changes by other teams. The main technique used for tackling these types of risks is for one or more of the engineers to build a feasibility prototype. An engineer will create the feasibility prototype because it is typically code, as opposed to most prototypes created by special-purpose tools intended to be used by product designers. A feasibility prototype is a long way from a commercially shippable product. The idea is to write just enough code to mitigate the feasibility risk. This typically represents just a small percentage of the work for the eventual shippable product. Further, most of the time the feasibility prototype is intended to be throwaway code. It's okay and normal to be quick and dirty with this. It is intended to be just enough to collect the data, for example, or to show that performance would likely be acceptable or not. There is usually no user interface, error handling, or any of the typical work involved in productization. In my experience, building a feasibility prototype requires usually just a day or two of time. If you're exploring a major new technology, such as a new approach leveraging machine learning technology, then the feasibility prototype could very well take significantly longer. The amount of time the feasibility prototype is estimated to take comes from the engineers. but whether or not the team takes that time depends on the product manager's judgment call as to whether it's worth pursuing this idea. She might say many other approaches to this problem don't have the technology feasibility risk, so she would rather skip this idea. While it's the engineers who do this feasibility prototyping work, it is considered discovery work and not delivery work. It's done as part of deciding whether to even pursue this particular approach or idea. In terms of lessons learned, I have seen many teams proceed to delivery without adequately considering the feasibility risk. Whenever you hear stories of product teams that grossly underestimated the amount of work required to build and deliver something, this is usually the underlying reason. It may be that the engineers were simply too inexperienced with their estimates, that the engineers and product manager had an insufficient understanding of what was going to be needed, or that the product manager did not give the engineers sufficient time to truly investigate. Chapter 47, User Prototype Technique. A user prototype, one of the most powerful tools in product discovery, is a simulation. Smoke and mirrors. It's all a facade. There is nothing behind the curtain. In other words, if you have a user prototype of an e-commerce site, you can enter your credit card information as many times as you want. You won't actually be buying anything. There is a wide range of user prototypes. At one end of the spectrum are low-fidelity user prototypes. A low-fidelity user prototype doesn't look real. It is essentially an interactive wireframe. Many teams use these as a way to think through the product among themselves, but there are other uses as well. Low-fidelity user prototypes, however, represent only one dimension of your product, the information in the workflow. There's nothing there about the impact of visual design or the differences caused by the actual data, to mention just a couple of important examples. At the other end of the spectrum are high-fidelity user prototypes. A high-fidelity user prototype is still a simulation. However, now it looks and feels very real. In fact, with many good high-fidelity user prototypes, you need to look close to see that it's not real. The data you see is very realistic, but it's not real either, mostly meaning it's not live. For example, if in my e-commerce user prototype example, I do a search for a particular type of mountain bike, it always comes back with the same set of mountain bikes. But if I look closely, they're not the actual bikes I asked for. And I notice that every time I search, it's always the same set of bikes, no matter what price or style I specify. If you are trying to test the relevance of the search results, then this would not be the right tool for the job. But if you are trying to come up with a good overall shopping experience or figure out how people want to search for mountain bikes, this is probably more than adequate, and it's very quick and easy to create. There are many tools for creating user prototypes for every type of device and for every level of fidelity. The tools are mainly developed for product designers. In fact, your product designer almost certainly already has one or more favorite user prototyping tools. It's also the case that some designers prefer to hand code their high-fidelity user prototypes, which is fine so long as they are fast and they are willing to treat the prototype as disposable. The big limitation of a user prototype is that it's not good for proving anything, like whether or not your product will sell. Where a lot of novice product people go sideways is when they create a high-fidelity user prototype and they put it in front of 10 to 15 people who all say how much they love it. They think they've validated their product, but unfortunately, that's not how it works. People say all kinds of things and then go do something different. We have much better techniques for validating value, so it's important that you understand what a user prototype is not appropriate for. This is one of the most important techniques for product teams, so it is well worth developing your team's skills and experience in creating user prototypes at all levels of fidelity. As you'll see in the coming chapters, a user prototype is key to several types of validation and is also one of our most important communication tools. Chapter 48. Live Data Prototype Technique. Sometimes, in order to address a major risk identified in discovery, we need to be able to collect some actual usage data. But we need to collect this evidence while in discovery, well before taking the time and expense of building an actual scalable and shippable product. Some of my favorite examples of this are when applying game dynamics, search result relevance, many social features, and product funnel work. This is the purpose of a live data prototype. A live data prototype is a very limited implementation. It typically has none of the productization that's normally required, such as the full set of use cases, automated tests, full analytics instrumentation, internationalization and localization, performance and scalability, SEO work, and so forth. The live data prototype is substantially smaller than the eventual product, and the bar is dramatically lower in terms of quality, performance, and functionality. It needs to run well enough to collect data for some very specific use cases, and that's about it. When creating a live data prototype, our engineers don't handle all the use cases. They don't address internationalization and localization work. They don't tackle performance or scalability. They don't create the automated tests, and they only include instrumentation for the specific use cases we're testing. A live data prototype is just a small fraction of the productization effort. In my experience, somewhere between 5 and 10% of the eventual delivery productization work. But you get big value from it. There are two big limitations you do have to keep in mind, however. First, this is code, so engineers must create the live data prototype, not your designers. Second, this is not a commercially shippable product. It's not ready for prime time, and you can't run a business on it. So if the live data tests go well, and you decide to move forward and productize, you will need to allow your engineers to take the time required to do the necessary delivery work. It is definitely not okay for the product manager to tell the engineers that this is good enough. That judgment is not up to the product manager. And the product manager does need to make sure key executives and stakeholders understand the limitations as well. Today, the technology for creating live data prototypes is so good that we can often get what we need in just a couple of days to a week. And once we have it, we can iterate very quickly. Later, we'll discuss the quantitative validation techniques, and you'll see the different ways we can utilize this live data prototype. But for now, know that the key is to be able to send some limited amount of traffic and to collect analytics on how this live data prototype is being used. What's important is that actual users will use the live data prototype for real work, and this will generate real data, analytics, that we can compare to our current product or to our expectations to see if this new approach performs better. Chapter 49, Hybrid Prototype Technique. So far, we've explored user prototypes, which are pure simulations, feasibility prototypes for addressing technical risks, and live data prototypes designed to be able to collect evidence, or even statistically significant proof, as to the effectiveness of a product or an idea. While these three categories of prototypes handle most situations well, a wide variety of hybrid prototypes also combine different aspects of each of these in different ways. One of my favorite examples of a hybrid prototype, and an exceptionally powerful tool for learning quickly in product discovery, is today often referred to as a Wizard of Oz prototype. A Wizard of Oz prototype combines the front-end user experience of a high-fidelity user prototype with an actual person behind the scenes performing manually what would ultimately be handled by automation. A Wizard of Oz prototype is absolutely not scalable, and we would never send any significant amount of traffic to this. But the benefit from our perspective is that we can create this very quickly and easily, and from the user's perspective, it looks and behaves like a real product. For example, imagine that today you have some sort of live chat-based help for your customers, but it's only available during the hours when your customer service staff is in the office. You know that your customers use your product from all around the world at all hours, so you would like to develop an automated chat-based system that provides helpful answers anytime. You could and should talk to your customer service staff about the types of inquiries they routinely get and how they respond. A concierge test could help you learn that quickly. Soon, you will want to tackle the challenges of this sort of automation. One way to learn very quickly and test out several different approaches is to create a Wizard of Oz prototype that provides a simple chat-based interface. However, behind the scenes, it is literally you as product manager or another member of your team who is receiving the requests and composing responses. Soon we begin to experiment with system-generated responses, perhaps even using a live data prototype of our algorithm. These types of hybrids are great examples of the build things that don't scale philosophy of product discovery. By being a little clever, we can quickly and easily create tools that let us learn very quickly. Admittedly, it's mainly qualitative learning, but that's often where our biggest insights come from anyway. Discovery testing techniques. Overview. In product discovery, we're essentially trying to quickly separate the good ideas from the bad as we work to try to solve the business problems assigned to us. But what does that really mean? We think of four types of questions we're trying to answer during discovery. 1. Will the user or customer choose to use or buy this? Value. 2. Can the user figure out how to use this? Usability. 3. Can we build this? Feasibility. 4. Is this solution viable for our business? Business viability. Remember that for many of the things we work on, most or all of these questions are very straightforward and low risk. Your team is confident. They have been there and done this many times before, and so we will proceed to delivery. The main activity of discovery is when these answers are not so clear. There is no prescribed order to answering these questions. However, many teams follow a certain logic. First, we will usually assess value. This is often the toughest and most important question to answer. And if the value isn't there, not much else matters. We likely will need to address usability before the user or customer can even recognize the value. In either case, we usually assess usability and value with the same users and customers at the same time. Once we have something that our customers believe is truly valuable, and we have designed it in a way that we believe our users can figure out how to use, then we'll typically review the approach with the engineers to make sure this is doable from their technical feasibility perspective. If we're also good on feasibility, then we'll show it to key parts of the business where there may be concerns. Think legal, marketing, sales, CEO, etc. We'll often address these business risks last because we don't want to stir up the organization unless we're confident it's worthwhile. Also, sometimes the ideas that survive are not so similar to the original ideas that we started with, and those original ideas may have come from a business stakeholder. It's much more effective to be able to show that stakeholder some evidence of what did and didn't work with customers and why and how you ended up where you are. Chapter 50, Testing Usability. Usability testing is typically the most mature and straightforward form of discovery testing, and it has existed for many years. The tools are better and teams do much more of this now than they used to, and this is not rocket science. The main difference today is that we do usability testing in discovery, using prototypes, before we build the product, and not at the end, where it's really too late to correct the issues without significant waste or worse. If your company is large enough to have its own user research group, by all means secure as much of their time for your team as you absolutely can. Even if you can't get much of their time, these people are often terrific resources, and if you can make a friend in this group, it can be a huge help to you. If your organization has funds earmarked for outside services, you may be able to use one of many user research firms to conduct the testing for you. But at the price that most firms charge, chances are that you won't be able to afford nearly as much of this type of testing as your product will need. If you're like most companies, you have few resources available and even less money. But you can't let that stop you. So I'll show you how to do this testing yourself. No, you won't be as proficient as a trained user researcher, at least at first, and it'll take you a few sessions to get the hang of it. But in most cases, you'll find that you can still identify the serious issues and friction points with your product, which is what's important. There are several excellent books that describe how to conduct informal usability testing, so I won't try to recreate those here. Instead, I'll just emphasize the key points. Recruiting users to test. You'll need to round up some test subjects. If you're using a user research group, they'll likely recruit and schedule the users for you, which is a huge help. But if you're on your own, you've got several options. If you've established the customer discovery program I described earlier, you are probably all set, at least if you're building a product for businesses. If you're working on a consumer product, you'll want to supplement that group. You can advertise for test subjects on Craigslist, or you can set up an SEM campaign using Google AdWords to recruit users, which is especially good if you're looking for users that are in the moment of trying to use a product like yours. If you have a list of email addresses from your users, you can do a selection from there. Your product marketing manager often can help you narrow down the list. You can solicit volunteers on your company website. Lots of major companies do this now. Remember that you'll still call and screen the volunteers to make sure the people you select are in your target market. You can always go to where your users congregate. Trade shows for business software, shopping centers for e-commerce, sports bars for fantasy sports, you get the idea. If your product is addressing a real need, you usually won't have trouble getting people to give you an hour. Bring some thank you gifts. If you're asking users to come to your location, you will likely need to compensate them for their time. We often will arrange to meet the test subject at a mutually convenient location, such as a Starbucks. This practice is so common, it's usually referred to as Starbucks testing. Preparing the test. We usually do usability testing with a high-fidelity user prototype. You can get some useful usability feedback with a low or medium fidelity user prototype. But for the value testing that typically follows usability testing, we need the product to be more realistic. More on why later. Most of the time, when we do a usability and/or value test, it's with the product manager, the product designer, and one of the engineers from the team, from those that like to attend these. I like to rotate among the engineers. As I mentioned earlier, the magic often happens when an engineer is present, so I try to encourage that whenever possible. If you have a user researcher helping with the actual testing, they will typically administer the test, but absolutely the product manager and designer must be there for each and every test. You will need to define in advance the set of tasks that you want to test. Usually these are fairly obvious. If, for example, you're building an alarm clock app for a mobile device, your users will need to do things like set an alarm, find and hit the snooze button, and so on. There may also be more obscure tasks, but concentrate on the primary tasks, the ones that users will do most of the time. Some people still believe that the product manager and the product designer are too close to the product to do this type of testing objectively, and they may either get their feelings hurt or only hear what they want to hear. We get past this obstacle in two ways. First, we train the product managers and designers on how to conduct themselves. And second, we make sure the test happens quickly, before they fall in love with their own ideas. Good product managers know they will get the product wrong initially and that nobody gets it right the first time. They know that learning from these tests is the fastest path to a successful product. You should have one person administer the usability test and another person taking notes. It's helpful to have at least one other person to debrief with afterward to make sure you both saw the same things and came to the same conclusions. Formal testing labs will typically have setups with two-way mirrors or closed-circuit video monitors with cameras that capture both the screen and the user from the front. That is fine if you have it, but I can't count how many prototypes I've tested at a tiny table at Starbucks, just big enough for three or four chairs around the table. In fact, in many ways, this is preferable to the testing lab because the user feels a lot less like a lab rat. The other environment that works really well is your customer's office. It can be time-consuming to do, but even 30 minutes in their office can tell you a lot. They are masters of their domain and often very talkative. In addition, all the cues are there to remind them of how they might use the product. You can also learn from seeing what their office looks like. How big is their monitor? How fast is their computer and network connectivity? How do they communicate with their colleagues on their work tasks? There are tools for doing this type of testing remotely, and I encourage that, but they are primarily designed for usability testing and not the value testing that will usually follow. So I view the remote usability testing as a supplement rather than a replacement. Testing your prototype. Now that you've got your prototype ready, lined up your test subjects, and prepared the tasks and questions, here are a set of tips and techniques for administering the actual test. Before you jump in, we want to take the opportunity to learn how they think about this problem today. If you remember the key questions in the customer interview technique, we want to learn whether the user or customer really has the problems we think they have, and how they solve those problems today, and what it would take for them to switch. When you first start the actual usability test, make sure to tell your subject that this is just a prototype, it's a very early product idea, and it's not real. Explain that she won't be hurting your feelings by giving her candid feedback, good or bad. You're testing the ideas in the prototype, you're not testing her. She can't pass or fail, only the prototype can pass or fail. One more thing before you jump into your tasks, see if they can tell from the landing page of your prototype what it is that you do, and especially what might be valuable or appealing to them. Again, once they jump into tasks, you'll lose that first-time visitor context, so don't waste the opportunity. You'll find that landing pages are incredibly important to bridging the gap between expectations and what the product does. When testing, you'll want to do everything you can to keep your users in use mode and out of critique mode. What matters is whether users can easily do the tasks they need to do. It really doesn't matter if the user thinks something on the page is ugly or should be moved or changed. Sometimes misguided testers will ask users questions like, "What three things on the page would you change?" To me, unless that user happens to be a product designer, I'm not really interested in that. If users knew what they really wanted, software would be a lot easier to create. So watch what they do more than what they say. During the testing, the main skill you have to learn is to keep quiet. When we see someone struggle, most of us have a natural urge to help the person out. You need to suppress that urge. It's your job to turn into a horrible conversationalist. Get comfortable with silence. It's your friend. There are three important cases you're looking for. 1. The user got through the task with no problem at all and no help. 2. The user struggled and moaned a bit, but he eventually got through it. Or 3. He got so frustrated, he gave up. Sometimes people will give up quickly, so you may need to encourage them to keep trying a bit longer. But if he gets to the point that you believe that he would truly leave the product and go to a competitor, then that's when you note that he truly gave up. In general, you'll want to avoid giving any help or leading the witness in any way. If you see the user scrolling the page up and down and clearly looking for something, it's okay to ask the user what specifically she's looking for, as that information is very valuable to you. Some people ask users to keep a running narration of what they're thinking, but I find this tends to put people in critique mode, as it's not a natural behavior. Act like a parrot. This helps in many ways. First, it helps avoid leading. If they're quiet and you really can't stand it because you're uncomfortable, tell them what they're doing. I see that you're looking at the list on the right. This will prompt them to tell you what they're trying to do, what they're looking for, or whatever it may be. If they ask a question, rather than give a leading answer, you can play back the question to them. They ask, "Will clicking on this make a new entry?" And you ask in return, "You're wondering if clicking on this will make a new entry?" Usually, they will take it from there because they'll want to answer your question. Yeah, I think it will. Parroting also helps avoid leading value judgments. If you have the urge to say, "Great," instead you can say, "You created a new entry." Finally, parroting key points also helps your note taker because she has more time to write down important things. Fundamentally, you're trying to get an understanding of how your target user thinks about this problem and to identify places in your prototype where the model the software presents is inconsistent or incompatible with how the user is thinking about the problem. That's what it means to be counterintuitive. Fortunately, when you spot this, it's not usually hard to fix, and it can be a big win for your product. You will find that you can tell a great deal from body language and tone. It's painfully obvious when they don't like your ideas, and it's also clear when they genuinely do. They'll almost always ask for an email when the product is out if they like what they see. And if they really like it, they'll try to get it early from you. Summarizing the learning. The point is to gain a deeper understanding of your users and customers and, of course, to identify the friction points in the prototype so you can fix them. It might be nomenclature, flow, visual design issues, or mental model issues, but as soon as you think you've identified an issue, just fix it in the prototype. There's no law that says you have to keep the test identical for all of your test subjects. That kind of thinking stems from misunderstanding the role this type of qualitative testing plays. We're not trying to prove anything here. We're just trying to learn quickly. After each test subject, or after each set of tests, someone, usually either the product manager or the designer, writes up a short summary email of key learnings and sends it out to the product team. But forget big reports that take a long time to write, are seldom read, and are obsolete by the time they're delivered because the prototype has already progressed so far beyond what was used when the tests were done. They really aren't worth anyone's time. Chapter 51, Testing Value. Customers don't have to buy our products, and users don't have to choose to use a feature. They will only do so if they perceive real value. Another way to think about this is that just because someone can use our product doesn't mean that they will choose to use our product. This is especially true when you're trying to get your customers or users to switch from whatever product or system they were using before to your new product. And most of the time, our users and customers are switching from something, even if that something is a homegrown solution. So many companies and product teams think all they need to do is match the features, referred to as feature parity. And then they don't understand why their product doesn't sell, even at a lower price. The customer must perceive your product to be substantially better to motivate them to buy your product, and then wade through the pain and obstacles of migrating from their old solution. All of this is a long way of saying that good product teams spend most of their time